fanzine o de romper este fanzine. I welcome you in this meeting. Hopefully that our deliberations today will take us somewhere. We will have a meeting that will take a resolution for us to go, how to go forward. We are taking too long to meet because of other parliamentary processes that are happening. We are taking a long time to meet because we keep on receiving information, interested people that want to come and present to us in the inquiry, and we have not, up to this moment, we have not yet set a date, a specific date, where we are going to start with the inquiry. Hopefully today, we will at least have a date of starting the inquiry. I hope so, members, in whatever deliberations that will take place today will lead us at least to a date, because it's been long. We started this process, or we took a decision on this process on the 23rd of May. That is 3 months back. And this is a process of a committee. We didn't have to set up an ad hoc committee. It is our process as a committee. I think we need to speed up, especially the process of starting, at least having a starting date from today. On our last meeting on the 25th of July, we made few amendments on the terms of reference, if we can remember well, because we extended the scope to Transnet and DNEL, and yet the terms of reference that we adopted in June, we did not have DNEL and Transnet. We were only focusing on Eskom. But on the 25th of July, we amended our terms of reference. The committee also on that day took a decision of having an evidence leader in the inquiry itself. I have spoken to the House Chairperson. I wrote a letter to the House Chairperson asking for an evidence leader. He looked for an advice from the legal people in Parliament. Today, I have invited the legal advisors to present to us specifically on the processes that we have to take on the inquiry, the process going forward. They are going to present to us the process. We will interact with the process that they are going to present to us, and we'll then take a decision. What are we making out of the process? Hopefully the legal, their legal document was distributed last night by email to all members. Honorable Chivam.
No, thanks, Chair. I thought that it should be standard that whenever we have a meeting, there must be minutes of the previous meeting, so that we're able to record what we agreed and confirm what we've agreed in the previous meeting. There's no minutes for this meeting. And I thought that we said that the support staff must go and draft the terms of reference, and so that we can make input. We said that it must be circulated via email, so that we make input and everything else there. I don't recall the decisions that about the legal office, but within your right as chair to, could of course, seek legal advice in terms of how we should proceed on this process. right, thought that there are certain agreements that were reached there and were supposed to be given access to certain documents, and we do not have those now. Looks like we're going around circles. You must remember that in the last meeting as well, there was an issue of the minutes saying that the previous meeting said that we must look into all state-owned companies that are under the Ministry and Department of Public Enterprises, and that was skipped when the terms of reference were being drafted. I don't know what might be the problem. I hope it's not support staff, because we're going to take serious issue if we take decisions and they're not recorded properly, and we end up having to take the same decisions time and again without making progress. Sure.
Thank you very much. Honorable Luyengi and Honorable Singh.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I think in concurring with the latter speaker as it relates to minutes of this meeting, and in as far as terms of reference, in order for us to maybe register appropriately the route that we wanted to take, I think in the last meeting, Chair, we were of the view that we need to be constitutionally and legally correct to pursue this process, and in that a submission was made by all of us that the administration must make sure that all those areas that wanted the administration to put them in the document, that should have been done. I think it must be presented, or we must get an understanding as to how far administratively that has happened. The issue of minutes is something that cannot be debated. It's a normality. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues. Must I say Acting Chairperson? And on that point, Acting Chairperson, I mean, I expressed a concern before that with this committee having such serious work to do, that's receiving the attention of almost all media houses here, I think it's important that this committee at its next meeting elects a chairperson. We cannot go into an inquiry like this without a full-time chairperson. And whoever that chairperson is might even be yourself, and I can even propose now, but I know it's not on the agenda. But we need to have a chairperson, and I think particularly the ruling party needs to deal with this issue, so that by the time we meet next, the first item on the agenda should be election of chairperson. But having said that, chairperson, I don't want to overkill the points that my two colleagues have mentioned. And I want to suggest that we start with the minutes of the meeting, 25th July, so we can ratify the decisions that were taken. Because the legal advice that we have today is taking us on a different path from what we had agreed to. And I don't want to say I told you so, because 2 or 3 months ago I did say we need to get all our ducks in a row before we proceed with this inquiry. But there was a certain haste for us to identify people that we wanted to invite. But having said that, that's water under the bridge. Let us deal with the minutes, and then we can deal with the legal advice and see how we take it from there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Oh, Honorable Sadin, Honorable Kwamu.
I think as much as it has always been standard practice for us to start with presentations as and when there are people who are coming to do presentations before the committee, maybe to address the issues that have been raised by comrades who spoke before. Let's take that road, let's start with the minutes instead of us attending to the presentation. It will definitely address all the concerns that have been raised. In other words, I'm seconding the professor, which says, let's start with the minutes and we'll take from there.
Yeah, you can call me Comrade Kwangwache, that's all right. No, he has taken the words out of my mouth. But I heard what Honorable Singh was saying around the election of the chairperson, and I think the UDM has a progressive proposal to make in this regard, that maybe we should consider doing that via secret ballot.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I am not sure why the minutes were not distributed with the legal opinion. I don't want to say I apologize. I don't know why were they not distributed with the legal document that was distributed yesterday. Because really, we usually get the minutes before we go to a minutes of the previous meeting before we go to the meeting of a day after. We get a minutes today and we read them. The following day we deal with them in the meeting. But now, because we have amended our agenda, I just want to make formal apologies.
It's only the apology that you've noted on, Mr. Gordon.
Okay. The apology of Honorable Gordon that was formally given, that's the only apology that we have. Honorable members, we will check the minutes then as per the suggestion and the resolution we took now at this committee, that we look at the minutes. We look at page one. Okay.
Chair, thank you. If you just record my name correctly, it's S. Swart, and African Christian Democracy. We like democracy, so if we just capitalize the democratic there. That's Democratic Party. Okay, absolutely. So if we just record, no, just capitalize the D, that's all. And Chair, if just for record purposes, if I just request, we are on record with my secretary, if just for this purposes of the ESCOM inquiry, if I could just get the notices, I'd really appreciate it electronically. I'm sure your committee secretary is doing that already, but just for record purposes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, thank you very much. At the meeting, the Democratic Alliance was represented by Honourable David Mania, and his name doesn't appear as a member present, so that could just be added to the minutes. Thank you.
Honourable Mainier, yes, we're part of the meeting. That's page one. Page two.
Sorry, Chair, page one again. Do we have two rondos, a DZ and a Z?
Where?
I see the name is mentioned twice, and the name of member, acting chairperson, Z Ronto, and then Miss DZ Ronto. So one should come out.
You know, I did not notice that because I thought the first name is for the chairperson of the committee, then the second name would obviously be my name. So I didn't notice that. Thank you very much. Otherwise, it's DZ Ronto. Page two.
Sorry, Chair, page one. I think Mr. Gordon was also there present. I don't see his name reflected there either.
Can we please ask the staff for such we can't have such just to oversee the members not their names not to appear on, because Honorable Pravin Gordhan is a permanent member of this committee. He is not an alternate. He is not also visiting like Honorable Swart. Instead, we can take Honorable Swart's name out and put Honorable Gordon's name. But Honorable Swart was part of the meeting. Therefore, that's why his name is here. But Honorable Gordon, we must have all our names. In fact, you must start with all our names, all permanent members of the committee. Then you can put other members in that are visiting or who have interest in the committee at the end of your letter, of your schedule. Page two. page 3. Honorable Mazon.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just as an observation, under the presentation of amended terms of reference, the last term of reference says that the list of witnesses should include executives that have been mentioned in presentations, including Mr. Seleke, Mr. Gupta, and Mr. Yelland. I think it's just important that we note that this isn't a group of people that replace the witnesses that we previously agreed to. This is simply an addition, because we'd agreed to people like Mr. Zizani Zuma and Atul Gupta and Mr. Raj Singh, Anuj Singh, in previous meetings. So this is simply an addition, not a substitution.
Yes, Chairperson, we're dealing with minutes. We're not dealing with the substantial issues. Minutes is for those who were in the meeting before. We're correcting or confirming that this is a correct reflection of the meeting. And if this matter is arising, then Honorable Mazon can come with that aspect that she's raising now.
Okay, let me do this. We are going to deal with the matters, first the matters arising from the minutes. Ne? We've already corrected the names and everything. And the second thing that we are going to do is to look at the items that we think are not included in the minutes, that we think should have been included after correcting all the mistakes or spellings and whatever, and English, the way English is written. So in that, and then we will look at the order of the resolutions that we took on that day and follow the order of the resolution as per the suggestion or the resolution of that day. I think those will be my submissions to the committee to make on the issue of the minutes. Honorable Singh.
Chairperson, I agree with you. Because, you know, I have a proposal that item 4 speaks to presentation on amended terms of references. I think item 5, the resolutions, should capture what we as a committee resolved, which is, some of which is not included in the current resolutions that have been presented before us. For example, the diesel contracts, and then the names of these people that have been mentioned, they should come under resolution. It's the resolutions of this committee that are important moving forward, not the presentation. Thank you, Chair. 3.4. The committee raised, I think it's concerns, there should be a plural there. And if we're referring to law enforcement agencies, if I remember correctly, the discussion related to the Hawks and the NPA. The Hawks are actually the law enforcement agency, so we should insert the word Hawks, in particular the Hawks and the National Prosecuting Authority. Thank you, Chair.
Anything else that comes out of the minutes? Can we then go to the resolutions that we, Honorable Shivam?
So, so that we do not limit ourselves, I thought that we agreed there that as part of the terms of reference, we should look broadly into all procurement of these state-owned companies. So procurement and financial sustainability and stability of those institutions. Because if we just mention diesel contracts only, it will then come back later to say, well, why are we now focusing on other wrongful procurement practices? I think that to cover it as the procurement of these state-owned companies and their current financial sustainability.
Chair, with respect, that's a substantive issue, and I would suggest that Honourable Shivam will bring up that substantive issue when we deal with the terms of reference.
I'm correcting what we agreed in the last meeting, because it had been made as a submission, so it has been the minutes as well.
No, we don't have to get into that, but I'm expecting you, Honourable Members, to deal with matters that are arising from the minutes. Do we have matters that are arising from the minutes? First, Honourable Tsedi, Honourable Singh, Honourable Luyenge, and Honourable Shivambo, in that order.
Honourable Chair, I think this is a true reflection of what we agreed upon on the day in which.
Okay.
Right. And if there are other issues that comrades would like to suggest, they will come at the stage where we will be talking about matters arising.
But Chairperson, matters arising would include the matter that you were reporting on as you started the meeting on Advocate Panara, because the committee would source the services of an external evidence leader. You were beginning to report on that, so I think you could report on that. Then the second issue arising is the fact that the committee agreed to amend the terms of reference, which will be circulated to members of the committee for comment. That hasn't been done. I think we need to note that was not done. And thirdly, we've not considered the necessity of inviting the public for comments. That's another matter that we've got to decide on. So the three matters arising.
Which I think that matter of not inviting the public for comment or inviting the public for bringing presentation, we need to discuss it also. Honorable Luyenge.
But I agree on these minutes reflecting on all what we actually discussed, more especially that I'm happy that the three Guptas now will all be there, because there was two initially, and then the third one in Tony was included and it is covered. Then the issue, Chair, in relation to the evidence leader, Mr. Advocate Panara, I'm sure it's covered here that there is a problem from the institution for us to get such an expertise, of which I think it's a serious issue that we must consider, because there is no way that we can we can unfold the processes in this exercise without the necessary appropriate and such an expertise that will actually legally and constitutionally profile this whole exercise. Maybe there will be a report that will actually be on top of that, because it cannot just end at not having Mr. Panara in the absence of Advocate Panara. What then?
No. Thanks, Chair. Maybe in summary, that the matter arising, number one, would be that the committee agreed to amend the terms of reference, so it must be presented that what happened at the circulation, so we need a report on that. Two is the issue of the evidence leader, and then three is the issue of inviting for public comment. So those are the three matters arising that specifically should be deliberated upon.
Let me take the issue of the evidence leader. I think in the presentation by the legal advisors, in the presentation that we are going to get, we are going to be told why are we not going to get an evidence leader. I remember this has been raised strongly by the members of the committee. They even took a resolution that says if we can't get the expertise of Mr. Panara as an evidence leader, the committee would want the parliament to seek outside person, a person from outside with the expertise. And we were worried about the time, and also we said we need a person that is going to go through all the documents, so that when that person leads us, he leads or she leads us knowing very well what is expected by the committee members in the inquiry. Because this is a very serious route that we have taken as the committee. We needed that resource as a committee and as a resolution of the committee. The other thing that I want to comment on or to raise my concern with the administration, the minutes, when they are written down, they must reflect exactly what has happened in the committee. If there were names that are supposed to be written in the minutes, let us write those names down. Because in we will keep on coming back to the minutes of the 25th of July going forward, because they are not reflecting what the committee has said. In terms of reference, in the minutes, terms of reference should have appeared as they are to be part of our minutes, so that we look at them as the members and reflect in them if the amendments are done or there is any mistake that is done in the terms of reference. I think that is that should be clear. I will give over to the secretary of the committee to give us the terms of reference as per the resolution that we took. I think they are not written. We don't have a written document that has the terms of reference now.
No, Chairperson, also we said that the terms of reference must be circulated via email to members. The secretary of this committee must explain why were the terms of reference not circulated, because, you know, this thing of tiptoeing around administration must come to an end. I saw yesterday also in the Portfolio Committee on Communications, as secretary of the committee who disorganizes the whole committee to the point of postponement of the committee meeting, we agreed here that the terms of reference must be circulated. Why are they not circulated? We fight for these workers when there are issues of disputes with the parliament secretary and their wage issues and everything else. We always take their side, but they must take us serious. Must respect us when we agree on something. How do you write minutes that say that you must circulate a document and you don't do it after you've written the minutes? Must be given an explanation as to why are the terms of reference not circulated as agreed, because it takes us back, it makes us to discuss things that we could have inputted via email and satisfied ourselves before we came here. Now we must listen to terms of reference which are possibly going to be made up here now. We must get an explanation and then we'll listen to the terms of reference after we got an explanation as to why were they not circulated.
Okay. I'll give over to the secretary.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to say that we did circulate the terms of references last week to all members of the committee. And then particularly for Mr. Shubambu, the committee assistant who had circulated the thing had initially forgotten your name, so I had to do it myself. Yourself, I did submit it, I can even give evidence. But with regards to the changes that have been made to the terms of references, they have been included, as members suggested, within the document that you submitted to all members of the committee. That was circulated.
Thank you, members. Are we satisfied? Honorable Luyenge.
I have a problem here. The administrator must come clear on this matter. Is he referring to this document, or is he referring to a document that is not amended that says terms of reference? Because this one, it's a framework for portfolio committee for public enterprise. So, or is it entailed in this document? Because I don't remember me receiving a document of terms of reference, not unless it's this one.
It's exactly that one. The terms of reference are in that document. It is you see the document that called framework for portfolio committee. It talks about the references that we are going to work around with. The terms of reference are there. Second page of the document. Page 2, yes. Yes. We can discuss them. We can discuss the terms of reference. What reflects on that page? Is it what we spoke about, or is something else that we think we did not speak about? Can we look at the page 2 of the document and see if that's what we were looking for? Honorable Singh, I see your hand was up.
Yeah, Chairperson, I think, you know, instead of us wasting time, maybe we need a document that should be circulated to us, headed terms of reference, so that we have it clear, not mixed with anything else, so even members of the public will know what the terms of reference of this committee are, bearing in mind that we also said that we resolved that we could amend as we go along. That was a caveats to the terms of reference. So if the Secretariat can prepare that and send it to us during the course of the day or whatever, if we have any challenges with it, we can discuss it at the next meeting. But I think we should proceed.
Thank you very much. Any additional something that members would want to say? Honorable Ria.
Maybe, Chairperson, if the Secretary has a reason to support the fact that this document is headed framework, because in terms of reference, there is some level of being close to what the framework is, and it causes confusion now when it is framework and then inside the terms of reference. Maybe can you elaborate more on this so that what Honorable Singh is saying is actually the decision that we are taking, that let us get a document that will say terms of reference, and then they get into that. Because in this document, you have a problem statement, you have it's another scholar kind of a document, which does not go particularly to the terms of reference.
Thank you, Honorable Member. I think that will be covered when the legal people are presenting. They will tell us why is this now frame of portfolio committee, framework of the portfolio committee, and not terms of reference. So they will explain it to us when we give them chance to present their legal document to us. That will be explained to. Honorable Sedi.
I don't think at this stage we still have issues that we still need to raise as part of the matters arise. Maybe let's allow a legal opinion to present and not avoid the temptation of getting into the issues that might emanate from the presentation.
Thank you very much. But what I want to ask to do is to adopt the minutes, because we need to adopt the minutes with all the amendments that are in front of us.
Moving for the adoption.
And the second. Honorable Moni.
I'm not here to counter the issue of adoption of minutes. My understanding is that the issue of terms of reference is a supposed included element in the minutes. Now, when we leave that, how are we leaving that part? Are we saying the minutes reflect terms of reference as agreed? Are we saying, what are we saying? I want us to clarify that part.
Honorable Noban.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like us to move with the suggestion of Honorable Singh, saying that maybe we adopt the minutes and request the Secretariat to provide us with a document that says terms of reference that will be attached to the minutes that we are going to adopt now. We'll adopt the minutes with the corrections and say they must attach that document that says terms of reference. And then we move that the legal people present and we engage on what they are about. Otherwise, you're going to go around in circles with minutes.
No, I think Honorable Nabanda is assisting to say you adopt the minutes subject to that element. And that is.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say the terms of reference that are not reflecting in the minutes. We need to have a separate document that will be attached as Honorable Banda has said, that will reflect in our minutes that these are the terms of reference. And we said in the last meeting, our terms of reference will keep on changing, because as we widen the scope, the terms of reference that were, we remember, they were focused on ESCOM, but now we have widened the scope. As we widen the scope, it means the terms of reference as we are going forward will be every now and again amended every now and again. That's what is going to happen. We are not going because we are trying to get into the depth of the problems that we have in the entities. Therefore, as we get information, as the inquiry is progressing, there will be things that will come out of the information that we'll get from the witnesses, and those issues will have to be included in the terms of reference of the inquiry. It is going to take us quite some time. We'll have to be patient, because the work that is in front of us, it's not a week's work. And whatever has happened to Eskom has not taken a month to put Eskom where Eskom is today. It has taken years for it. We might do it in this term, but maybe next term also. When the term starts in 2019, the Committee of Public Enterprise at that time will have to carry on with those issues. Honorable Swart.
No, Chair, I am in agreement with the suggestions, but I think it's largely covered by my suggested insertion of any other related matters. So that will enable us to broaden our inquiry, because that is covered with that. So I'm quite happy with us looking at the minutes as they are, accepting it with the suggestions. But I do see in our in the framework there is an amended terms of reference which should be in the minutes, and we will get back and discuss that. But I see the suggestion there. There's even a word that is a very emotional word there, phase two, Transnet's locomotive tender and a 5.3 billion kickback. Now, maybe that's not a word. We will discuss the usage of words later. Alleged payment or something like that. But that encapsulates, I think, what Mr. Honourable Shabamba said last time. His suggestion is now included in this terms of reference, but it should be in the minutes. I think that's the point that's made. So we accept the minutes subject to these changes. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Shabamba.
Well, thanks, Chair. I would think that perhaps to be on the safe side, because can't we say that this inquiry is going to be an inquiry on Eskom, Denel, and Transnet, and it will focus on all issues that relate to 1, governance, 2, procurement, 3, financial sustainability of those state-owned companies, and any other related matter. Because when we are later on subjected to judicial review, they will say that part of the reasons why we found it to have been on the wrong is that the terms of reference were changing in each and every committee. So it might expose us to unnecessary judicial review. So let us agree in principle that all issues that relate to governance, to procurement, and financial sustainability and stability of Eskom, Transnet, and Denel, so that we're able to cover as wide a range of issues as possible. And then we present a report that, with regards to Denel on governance issues, this is what we've identified, and these are our recommendations. On procurement, this is what we've identified, these are our recommendations. On financial sustainability, this is what we have discovered, and this is our comment. And we'll do the same thing with Eskom and Transnet. I think we'll then be able to cover the necessary ground and then come with the recommendations that could help those state-owned companies be sustainable in the future. Sure.
Thank you, agreed, members. Then we will now go to the presentation. We're done with the minutes. We'll go to the presentation of on legal opinion regarding the inquiry.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, members of the committee, and guests. My name is Suan Isaac. I'm from Parliament.
Can I just give me just one minute to something that I wanted to say to the committee. I wanted to say to the committee, because the committee has suggested that we ask for the services of Mr. Vanara, and it was raised here. I did not respond to it. The services of Mr. Vanara we cannot get, especially him, because he is busy in the office of the members' interest. There are cases that he is looking at. There are many things. There is a lot of work that is in front of us. That's what we got from the office of Mr. Frolic, the chair of chairs. That's what he said to us. We can't have the access. And also, speaking to him with some for somebody coming from outside, we also raise an issue. If we can't get Honorable Vanara, therefore, we can have a legal person from outside who can look at the documents and read them and lead us in the inquiry. That also will be covered by the legal document, but also that Parliament also said they do not have resources or they would not have money to get that person from outside, because any person that would do that from outside will require a lot of money from Parliament, so Parliament will not afford that person. Thank you very much. We can now give over to the legal advisors.
Thank you, Chair. As I was saying, my name is Suan Isaac and I'm from Parliament Legal Services, and with me is my colleague Fatima Ibrahim. Chairperson, from the last meeting, there was a discussion regarding the use of an evidence leader, and I think in the meeting people had mentioned the ad hoc committee on the SABC board inquiry and used this as an example as to how this particular committee must conduct its oversight over ESCOM and other state-owned enterprises. We were specifically asked to look at the legal issues and the legal implications of using either a staff member or an outside expert to lead evidence in a parliamentary committee. So I've started by looking at the constitutional framework and the mandate of Parliament. So I'm just going to go through that. I know many of the members are well versed as to what their constitutional mandate is, but I just want to use this to explain as to how I've arrived at my conclusion. So in terms of Section 42(3) of the Constitution, the National Assembly is elected to represent the people and to ensure government by the people under the Constitution. And it does this, among others, by scrutinizing and overseeing executive action. Now, the Constitution empowers the Assembly and its members in various ways to carry out this oversight mandate. For instance, Section 55(2) of the Constitution directs that the Assembly must provide mechanisms to hold and oversee the executive and organs of state. Section 56 of the Constitution gives the Assembly wide powers in that the Assembly and its committees can summon people to testify under oath or to produce documents. They can ask any institution to report to it. And failure to comply with summons is a criminal offence. Further, Section 57(1) directs that the Assembly can determine its own internal arrangements, proceedings and procedures. And 57(1)(b) directs that the Assembly can draft its rules with due regard to representation and participation. That is the framework from the Constitution. That is the mandate given to the Assembly and its committees. Now, the rules of the Assembly is created to deal with the daily functioning of committees and how you go about your task. The rules, firstly, reiterate the mandate of the Constitution and elaborate on the functioning of the Assembly. For this specific issue, we need to look at Rule 227, which gives us the functions of portfolio committees. Now, Rule 227 states that portfolio committees must maintain oversight of the exercise of national executive authority and any executive organ within its portfolio. Portfolio committees may monitor, investigate, inquire into, and make recommendations concerning any such executive organ of state, including the legislative program, on legislative program, budgets, rationalization, restructuring, functioning, organization, structure, staff, and policies of any organ of state. Now, further, the Constitution gives members, firstly, a right and a very important protection. In Section 58(1), members are granted freedom of the Assembly and its committees, and further, they have immunity from civil and criminal proceedings for anything they say or produce in the House. Now, if we apply, now that we understand our constitutional framework and the basis that I'm now going to explain my opinion from, I just want to talk about how this mandate applies to oversight. The oversight and accountability model was adopted by Parliament, and it defines oversight as follows. In the South African context, oversight is the constitutionally mandated function of legislative organs of state to scrutinize and oversee executive action at any organ of state. Now, when members are carrying out this oversight function, they are acting as representatives of the people to ensure accountability and transparency in our democracy. Members have a mandate to hold the executive and organs of state to account as a multi-party body representing the diverse interests of the people of South Africa. And this is one of the primary reasons that members are elected to office by citizens of South Africa. Now, oversight is not something that is new to Parliament. The National Assembly and its committees in successive parliaments have conducted oversight through various mechanisms. But what is important to note is that all such processes have always been led and been directed by members of the committees and the assembly. There is no precedent for the oversight powers of elected representatives and of a multi-party committee being delegated to either a staff member or an external service provider. So while it is imperative that in carrying out its oversight mandate, members are provided with the maximum support of staff and any other necessary resources that they may identify and require. However, it must always remain the purview of members to lead and direct oversight processes. This ensures that multi-party interests and dynamics are voiced during oversight. Now, if a member of staff or an external service provider is required to lead this process, they will have to adopt a politically neutral approach and will not be able to represent multiple interests in examining issues. They may have their own slants and their own bias in examining those issues. So the other issue that I want to re-emphasize is that the Constitution gives the committees and its members specific powers to conduct its oversight. As I said, they have the right to summon people to appear before it, and if a person fails to adhere to a summons, it's a criminal offense. The other important issue that must be unpacked is of parliamentary privilege and the absolute importance that parliamentary privilege plays in oversight. Now, members have the freedom of speech to say whatever they want within the rules and orders and are free from the threat of criminal or civil proceedings. Now, the Constitutional Court has affirmed the importance of parliamentary privilege in ensuring effective oversight. The Court has stated that parliamentary privilege encourages democracy and full and effective deliberations. It removes the fear of repercussions for what is said. In the case of Democratic Alliance versus Speaker from 2006, the Constitutional Court again said, for Parliament to properly to exercise its oversight function over the executive, it must operate in an environment that guarantees members freedom of arrest, detention, prosecution, or harassment of whatever nature. Absent this freedom, Parliament may be cowed with results that oversight of the executive may be illusory. Now, the important point to note is that this parliamentary privilege is only applicable to members. It does not extend to members of staff or to third parties. And if this has to be done, it must be done through statute. So external persons or members of staff do not have the freedom to say what they wish without the possibility of being held liable, either civilly or criminally. This is always a potential risk in that they will be guarded or not be able to effectively conduct the evidence process. Members are not similarly restrained and therefore can conduct oversight robustly and effectively. The next issue that I want to address is the use of the SABC inquiry as a benchmark. The SABC inquiry is fresh in all our minds, and we want to now obviously have an effective and similar process to get the work of the committee done. But I just want to draw the members' attention to the fact that The SABC inquiry was done specifically in terms of legislation. In terms of Section 15A of the Broadcasting Act of 1999, the National Assembly is able to recommend the dissolution of the SABC board on specific grounds that are listed in the Act. And the National Assembly can do this after due inquiry and adopting a resolution. Now, the other committee on the SABC was established to conduct this inquiry and make a recommendation to the National Assembly. This task could have also been done by a portfolio committee on communications, but the main issue that must be noted is that this was done in terms of the Broadcasting Act. Now, you see, the difference that I want to draw here is that the process adopted in this SABC inquiry took on a quasi-judicial nature, with them putting an evidence leader in place to lead witnesses. The point here was that because there were specific grounds on which a finding had to be made, evidence had to be led to come to that particular finding, and therefore the committee adopted a process that was more administrative and quasi-judicial in nature. However, this was not the only option available to them. They could have asked members to ask the questions and have still come to the same conclusion. There's other examples of the so-called quasi-judicial processes that are used in Parliament in specific instances. Now, when I say quasi-judicial, I mean it has similarities with court proceedings where there must be some kind of finding at the end of it. People must be able to, you know, cross-examine witnesses. So that's what I mean when I say that. So there are two processes where we use sort of an evidence leader is in terms of the Powers, Privileges and Immunity Act. First year, when a member is charged with breaching the act, a disciplinary hearing can be initiated and a person will be appointed as an initiator to lead evidence. And there's all these other, following from such a process, there's all these other procedural requirements that come into play. The other example is when there's a breach of the ethics code, the registrar, if there's a hearing, will lead evidence. And again, there's all these requirements of procedure that people be able to be legally represented or given certain, they must be following certain procedural rules. So as I've indicated, firstly, from the SABC inquiry, from the ethics inquiry, from the powers and privileges inquiry, these are specific types of inquiries, and I want to term these statutory inquiries because they are done specifically in terms of law or rules. And therefore, they take on this quasi-judicial or administrative process and have more stricter adherence to rules of natural justice. Now, if a committee chooses to go on this quasi-judicial or administrative route, then they must be aware that there is further requirements that they follow procedural justice and natural justice to ensure the processes are fair. It's not that this committee doesn't follow it in its oversight processes, but I'm saying that when you have a process which is more quasi-judicial in nature, the requirements are stricter. For instance, the case of Mayamani versus chairperson of the Joint Committee on Ethics and Members' Interests. Here, the decision of the committee was returned because the court held that the ethics committee was required to adhere to the fundamental rules of procedural justice, the constitution, and the procedures set out in the ethics code. So the closer you get to stricter processes and the more strictly you need to adhere to the rules of procedural and natural justice, the more you open yourself up for judicial review. So that is a huge concern. Now let us look at oversight. Now when we look at oversight, what does an oversight inquiry entail? We want to oversee and hold the executive to account or an organ or state to determine whether they have carried out their responsibilities in terms of law, their mandate, ethically, and in the best interest of the country. We want to see if they have adhered to law and policy. Now the inquiry that is to be undertaken by this committee, in my opinion, falls strictly within its oversight mandate. It gets this mandate from the Constitution and specifically Rule 227. This committee will embark on a fact-finding mission. It will look at evidence. It will look at information. And it does not have to arrive at a specific conclusion. It will analyze whatever is presented to it and make recommendations and propose various actions. So unlike the SABC inquiries, does not have a narrow focus. So my point here is that we must differentiate when a committee is conducting an inquiry in terms of specific law, or is it conducting an inquiry in terms of its broader oversight mandate, where it has broader powers and it is conducting its normal parliamentary work, although we are now dealing with specific issues and terming this an inquiry. Other considerations I want members to note is that Parliament and this committee is not conducting a criminal investigation or a criminal trial. And the National Assembly's proceedings differ greatly from court proceedings. The other important issue that if we now embark on a particular process for this committee, we are setting a precedent for all future inquiries. So other committees who want to have an inquiry or a similar investigation will also want to appoint an evidence leader. And if we use the services of an external service provider, then the cost in the long term for Parliament is going to be astronomical. So what is the way forward? In terms of Parliament's oversight model, what it envisions is that oversight processes are directed by members of Parliament who are supported by staff, and members must be provided with any additional resources that they require to do their work effectively. We can have regard to one of the committees who successfully undertakes oversight in Parliament, and that is SCOPA. They do embark on very difficult issues, and the members lead the processes, and they obviously have their own in-house methods of doing that, and the committee can consider looking at SCOPA as one example. So in conclusion, I just want to reiterate the point that the Constitution mandates the Assembly to conduct oversight, and this differs from what the committee is embarking on is an inquiry in terms of its oversight mandate. Not an inquiry in terms of a statutory, it's not a statutory inquiry. The next point I want to emphasize is that the Constitution envisions and the Parliament and the process of Parliament must be conducted by a multi-party in a multi-party environment to enable that various citizens are represented. Only elected representatives can fulfill this obligation. Next, I want to say that members must receive support from staff and have access to any resources that they require to effectively conduct oversight. But they must not relinquish their oversight power to unelected officials or third parties. Members must both lead and direct oversight processes. And lastly, the issue of parliamentary privilege is a concern because while members are free to say whatever they want to within the rules and are immune from civil and criminal liability, members of staff and third parties do not enjoy such a protection. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. That is the presentation that we get from the legal advisors. I will allow the members to ask questions. Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Mazumi, Honorable Gungubele, Honorable Swart, Honorable Shivambo, and Honorable Singh, Honorable Gwangwa, Honorable Seidi.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let me appreciate first the submission by the legal team, save to indicate my total dismay at the failure of Parliament to provide the necessary resources for this purpose, as it emanated from us as a portfolio committee, and a commitment was made by Parliament that let us do our work as entailed in the Constitution, and the necessary resources will be provided. And the issue here, Chairperson, there is a hypothetical view that there are trillions of monies being used in a manner that is not appropriate. And that is a problem statement that actually prompted us as public representatives that there is, we actually smelling a rat that there are people, there are institutions and families that are looting the state resources. Now, the very same state is unable now to provide resources to unearth what is inappropriate. I'm not well with that. Not unless Chairperson, you will elaborate on this and motivate me to accept a situation whereby, as Parliament, we are saying we are not able to do our work because of money, and we are looking for money that is being stolen here. Even if we can sell our shoes and then get the necessary resources that we unearth, these people must know, we want to know. I don't think that is a view. It's not acceptable. Secondly, the issue of the evidence leader. We fully understand our responsibilities and obligations as members of parliament, as a portfolio committee. But if we don't have the necessary expertise in order that we don't mess up with the process, and that particular director will be doing that particular work on our behalf and is covered with the statutes that covers us. Because, Chairperson, even the legal representatives here are not members of parliament. What covers them to do what they are doing now? It's a contradiction, Chair. That particular individual will not dictate terms as an evidence leader. Members of parliament will do our work, will engage. So it is not right for us to be regarded as if we want someone who will be delegated all our functions. We will never delegate the power that we're given by the masses. But we want to be professional, we want to be acute in dealing with it, in order that, because we are dealing with people, we are dealing with integrities of people, and we also have integrities to protect. And there is no way that we will call people and then we mess up with their names without having the necessary resource to do that. Quasi nature of the SABC inquiry. There is no need for us to compare other inquiries about this. This issue that is taking place now, it has got something to do with the entities. And we say we want to deal with the three entities that we, that is your ESCOM, DINEL, and Transnet. Because we don't want to shoot all over the place as if we don't know what we want. We know we are smelling a rat here. It's not that there is nothing happening elsewhere. But for us now to be regarded as if we are outsourcing what we should be doing, it's something that is not helping us. It's not helping us, but the commitment was that we will be assisted by Parliament. We know we are not going to conclude this process. We will recommend, and then the conclusion will be done by Parliament. And it will definitely go back to where it's supposed to do, to the law enforcement agents, if it has to. Bosla.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, I think it's very important that we remember that the inquiries into state capture were in fact an urgent instruction given to portfolio committees from the Chair of Shares, Mr. Cedric Frolic. So I agree 100% to come now and say that to acquire external legal advice or an external evidence provider will be of astronomical cost. It's just, it's absolutely ludicrous in its nature to think that Parliament would not give such a resource to a committee that's about to embark, in the first committee that's about to embark on a state capture investigation. So, I mean, you're in a catch-22 situation. You actually follow an instruction given by the Chair of Chairs, and then your very own institution turns around and tells you, well, we don't have the monetary requirements to give you the necessary backup. Now, the legal opinion says very clearly that we must be given every resource possible. Now, what, and another part of the inquiry tells us that the inquiry must be multi-party in its nature. Now, the reason it's multi-party in its nature is to give a complete overview and to give an unbiased political approach to the inquiry. Now, I mean, I'm in a fortunate position where there are enough DA members to attend various committees, et cetera, et cetera. But we must also bear in mind that we deal with smaller political parties who may not have the time and the resources of their own to embark on such an inquiry without an external evidence leader leading the way in terms of how the inquiry goes. Also, there's going to be masses of evidence that need to be collated, information gathered for future investigations. This is simply impossible for members of Parliament to do the admin side of it and the legal side of it while executing their oversight role. Now, while I understand completely that we are protected under powers and privileges, and I'm more pleased than ever that we are, the evidence leader is exactly that. They start the process of leading the evidence. It is then up to the members of Parliament who are versed in what's going on in the different spectrums, who know what's going on in the portfolios, who have worked on these issues for months and months, to then interrogate the witnesses or the evidence at hand, and to then add, so the evidence leader creates the skeleton, and the members then add the flesh to the skeleton. That is my understanding of our role, and it's the way it's always been done. So I don't think that we need to concern ourselves with an evidence leader being worried about not being protected by powers and privileges. We as members of Parliament, it is our duty to then enter into robust debate and into robust questioning and perhaps questioning that an ordinary member of the public could not enter into. So I think that is an argument that we don't have to worry about. In terms of worrying about a broad spectrum investigation in terms of being quasi-judicial in nature, I don't think we have to worry about that either, because South African law lends itself to a narrow approach or a broad approach. It's one of the areas that we have leniency, and I think that in Parliament we must also have leniency when we look at entering into a quasi-judicial approach that is broader than a narrow scope. Yes, we're not doing a statutory inquiry, but we've agreed in terms of our terms of reference that we're going the broad approach, and South African national justice allows for us to take a narrow approach or a broad approach, and we have simply chosen to go with a broad approach to this committee. I think that we contradict ourselves in saying that we use the SABC inquiry as a benchmark, but then we immediately in the legal opinion say, but we're not going to follow that approach. I don't think we should use anything as a benchmark. I think it's appreciated by the committee as well as by Parliament that this is the first inquiry of its nature that's being embarked upon. And that hence the broader approach that we are using as members of Parliament. So I don't think that we need to stick to any ambient when looking at inquiries. And yes, while I agree that SCOPA perhaps is a good starting point, one must remember that the actual functioning of SCOPA in terms of how it functions as a committee is very different to the way any other committee functions, because their role is as an investigative portfolio committee. Public Enterprises, as its role as a committee, is not investigative. We are there to provide oversight, but we perform a completely separate function. Hence the reason, for example, that SCOPA will always have a chairperson who does not belong to the governing party because of their investigatory role that they play in Parliament. So I don't think that those two should be placed in the same. Ambient as the Public Enterprises portfolio. Chair, I think it's absolutely essential that we get to the bottom of two things. One, why is there now a sudden pushback to having an external evidence leader? Because certainly there never was in the past. And two, I think we need to question very seriously, how serious is Parliament taking the role of our oversight oath and our constitutional mandate? If when we come down to the crunch and we finally get to doing the job that we should have done ages ago, that now we are told that the resources aren't available, because the state law advisor and the parliamentary law advisors have told us today that every possible resource will be made available. Well, in that case, it is my opinion that an external evidence leader is one of the resources that we need to conduct our oversight on effectively.
Sorry? Oh, it's Honorable Gungubel. Okay. Sorry for that.
I know singing is nice to pronounce. my surname is quite... Let me put it this way. Because I think we're engaging a legal presentation. Maybe to... Honorable Yang has actually gone to some of the issues. Let's put it this way. Just to repeat what he said, just one aspect of what he said. You are saying we must lead as politicians, we must direct. But when we say we want to be informed, in that leadership. I hope they are listening. I'm saying, let me repeat this. From that I was a teacher at school, sometimes I look at the people I'm talking to. I'm saying, we are saying, politicians must lead, politicians must direct. But when politicians says, we want to be resourced so that we can lead, effectively, the statement is no. We want to lead and lead effectively. We're saying we want a resource to do that. Two, without belaboring what Member Jenny said, whatever advice you give us here is subject to review, and any court can find you wrong. How protected are you? Because if it starts there, we must not take your advice. Because you are advising us on how to conduct ourselves. That's what you're asking. And if you give us an advice on how to conduct ourselves, the way we conduct ourselves has got implications. It may be found to be wrong. Who protects you? Because you're not members of parliament. And I think, without belaboring what Member Jenny said, let me come to the other point of quasi-judicial. Quasi-judicial, colleagues, deals with, let me start at the chair. If there's a possibility of reaching a conclusion on the basis of which you may take actions, both the conclusion or end or actions can affect the rights of individuals. I want to repeat that, can affect the rights of individuals, their status in society, their credibility, and everything in society. That's what quasi-judiciary does, but it's not a court framework, but it's something that is meant to be compared to court. So that if you are reviewed, the court can say there was an application of the mind on how fair this conclusion can be reached, although not within the court principles. Now, if quasi-judicial performs that role, why would it not be applied in a process where you are going to interrogate people, ask them questions that possibly implicate them with regard to being viewed as corrupt, as fraudulent, and that is their image? Why would you exclude quasi-judiciary, which gives you a framework on how to be fair before you reach that conclusion? Because court, you must demonstrate that there was an attempt to be fair before you reach a conclusion that can negatively reflect on somebody. This is a serious question. So, now, you come with the other point that says precedent setting. There is no precedent setting in Parliament in terms of our committee's work. This thing of precedence is a court ranking. It's a judicial system's ranking. That if so many judges take this decision, those below are bound. There's no such setting system here. Each committee has to take decisions and approach based on its own merits and the situation that it is dealing with. It doesn't have to check what other committee did. But when it does that, it must not be illegal. That's the case. It doesn't have to be precedent. Because you must show us the rule of precedence here in terms of committees doing their work. And I want to repeat that. Show us the rule that governs precedent system on how committees do their work. Right? Now, you are saying in quasi, you go based on particular rules with an intended finding. But how different is what we are doing here? And then how can a committee of parliament not work in terms of the rules? You say something you call quasi, certain rules must be applied. How can a committee of parliament not work within certain rules? It works in certain rules, and it's going to be challenged on how it has applied those rules, which actually govern its work. And now, if you've got rules, quasi is always protecting you to demonstrate that you had an intention to use those rules and put a process to fairly reach conclusions on the basis of fairness, so that whatever you recommend, if that person goes to court must, these ordinary South Africans tried to put a process of fairness before they can implicate people's integrities. So all I'm saying, I want you to advise us, how are you asking us to go willy-nilly? Because, let me put it this way, you are advising us to go willy-nilly. You just call people, ask them whatever you want to ask, otherwise it's your duty. Forget about a skilled person to assist you to ask this question in a sensible way. Otherwise you've got powers as politicians to use those powers in whichever way you want. So I think maybe as you come back, clarify us on these issues. And
Chairperson, I'm sure I was not the next one, but if you're giving me the opportunity. Oh, was it? All right, okay, you are the chair. Swat Chivambo and then sing. But anyway, if you want me to sing, I will sing.
No, you change with
me then. Okay, so it's me now. Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think we thank the legal advisors for what they've put down. For me, it's important that we do not miss the wood for the trees. The objective of this committee for months now has been to get to the bottom of graft and corruption in some of the state-owned enterprises. And I think we have received evidence, or we've received presentations, representation from some of these state-owned enterprises in the last 6 or 8 months, which we are not satisfied with. For example, the VR Malaysia issue and other issues. We were certainly not satisfied. And I think arising out of that and these emails that surfaced and the report on state capture, we felt that it was necessary to conduct a full-blown inquiry into what's happening into these state-owned enterprises, starting off with Eskom. Now we've included Denel and Transnet. I would hate us to not start that work earnestly and try and look at whether we need an evidence leader or not. I know 3 months ago I suggested to this committee that we need to get our ducks in a row, we need expertise, we need evidence leader, we need to know if Parliament has the resources, both financial and human, to capacitate this committee. We didn't get an answer to that question and we proceeded on the basis that we did. But that's water under the bridge. I still feel that if we are serious about getting to the bottom of this graft and corruption, and even if we do not have an evidence leader, we need to be assured by the powers that be, that handle finances in Parliament, that we as a committee will be provided with the necessary expertise, appropriate expertise, to enable us to conduct our work. And I think I was the first to admit 3 months ago that I don't have the expertise, you know, to get into the forensic side of some of these contracts which will run into hundreds of millions of rand. And for us to be questioning, you know, I can bet my bottom dollar, and I don't have many dollars, that the people that we are going to invite, Rand, to give evidence before us, or that we're going to question, will come with advocates, will come with senior counsels, will come with accountants, and they'll come with the best brains, because they realized that arising out of the SABC ad hoc committee, which I think my colleague and I who sat and Honorable Kwang was sat on, I don't think the people that we invited to that committee realized that the outcome and the recommendations of that committee could have been as serious as it was. And it would have serious implications on certain individuals. So here people are going to protect their interests from the word go, so they are not liable for criminal investigation and being put into jail. I would like to see some of these people involved in this graft and corruption put behind bars and the keys thrown away, because they've been robbing our poor taxpayers of hard-earned money that we contribute to the fiscus. Now, having said that, Chair, my view would be, if we can get an assurance from Parliament, and maybe we need to engage whether it's Mr. Frolic or the Speaker, whoever controls finances, on what our needs are. We have to identify what our needs are going to be. Right? And I sat on SCOPA for many years, and I think Honorable Shivambu sat on SCOPA for many years. We work on a basis there of identifying the issues, but the difference that Honorable Natasha has said is that in SCOPA you are guided by the report of the Auditor General. And the Auditor General, Office of the Auditor General, provides you with lots of information, background. Here we don't have anything. We have nothing to start from. We have emails, we have newspaper articles, so we need something to start from. So research has to be done in that regard. So I would still be somewhat comfortable if we can get experts that we need to identify, if we can identify the areas that we need to interrogate. For example, let's say Tegeta. We need somebody to look into Tegeta, what happened, the contracts, and work with a member of this committee. Supposing it's Honorable Shivambu. He could be assigned the evidence leader duties in that meeting to interrogate whoever we call here on the whole together issue, backed by this researcher or this whatever support we can get. And then members can ask follow-up questions. And I think in that way, without, you know, having an evidence leader, we'll still be capable of getting the work done. The important thing is for us to, as quickly as possible, to get to the bottom of this. And I just have a funny feeling that there may be some powers that be somewhere who have realized that this committee is going to do serious work, and that we are all committed across political parties to getting to the bottom of this, and that they are trying to put a spanner in the works. We must not allow that to happen as members of Parliament who are committed to the South African public. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, as you know, I'm a member of the Justice and Correctional Services Committee, and so I want to align myself with Mr. Singh being concerned, he wanting to put people behind the bars and throw keys away. While I've been doing some oversight visits, I've been seeing some very nice cells for those people. But the key thing is we need to get back the money as quickly as possible that is flowing out on a day-to-day basis. So that's why it's urgent. That's why all of us need to attend to this very urgently. Now, looking at the legal opinion, as a lawyer myself, I understand the distinction between the SABC inquiry, which was in terms of the SABC Act, the Broadcasting Act, and this oversight inquiry. But the key thing is we are facing unprecedented levels of state capture. So I don't think we can say that because that inquiry, let's set that inquiry aside. What we are doing here is unprecedented level of oversight in massive SOEs that is going to require a level of expertise. We as MPs have got a degree of that expertise. We've got lawyers amongst us. But for us to do all that work, let us think again what happened at the SABC inquiry. We had an inquiry leader, and then the MPs added the questions afterwards. So that brought in the multi-party dimension that concerns you. I also don't see the problem that you mentioned in paragraph 18, where you say they do not have the freedom of speech, because you use the very word here to put various allegations to witnesses without the possibility of being held civilly and criminally. They are allegations. And so exactly the same with the SABC inquiry. Advocate Venara was an official that put the allegations. He did not enjoy the Power and Privileges Act protection, even though it was a statutory inquiry. So for us to make use, and I think it is unfair, Chairperson, you know, we as Parliament, the executive is a year later still not doing the Commission of Inquiry that was recommended by the Public Protector, a year later. That Commission of Inquiry will cost tens of millions of rands. They will have 5-6 lawyers presenting evidence. Every person giving evidence will have lawyers. And for us not to have one junior attorney or a junior advocate at the bar that is struggling to make a living, that we can support a junior member. In the Justice Committee, we're continually having young advocates saying, we don't have work, we don't have work. And for us to find that amount of money, I think is disgraceful. I think we need to find that person. But if we can't, and if there is a reason why Parliament is not prepared to go that route, then we need to start working on this issue as quickly as possible, Chair. We need to start, and maybe outside the meeting, we need to have a multi-party caucus where we say, right, let's start dividing the work up, because we can't delay the matter any further. And I think, Chair, so whilst I support my colleagues saying we need that external evidence leader, this is an unprecedented matter. We're not necessarily setting a precedent going forward. It would be helpful. But if the powers that be say they're not prepared to concede, then we need to start working and amongst ourselves dividing the work up so that we can continue. We can't allow delays in this process any further. Time is of the essence. And I agree that this matter is going to go on and on for some time. It could go months. It could go even years. At the end of the day, this Parliament findings will have to refer to other institutions again to do the criminal investigations. But we've already said they're not doing it. So the quicker we get our work, like the SABC inquiry, we made recommendations that are being followed up now. We need to, in the public domain, expose what is going on within our powers. And then we need to make further recommendations. So thank you for that, Chairperson.
Thank you. Honourable Shivam.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. So in terms of the minutes of the 25 July, which we just adopted, we did not solicit any legal opinion in terms of this process. We said it was time to the relevant authorities to give us an evidence leader, either internal with said Venara or an external advisor. And then we then responded with a legal opinion, which is giving us financial advice. But this is, we heard the lawyers say that this is too expensive. What is legal about it? What law? Because this is something which is supposed to be said by the CFO of Parliament or by someone who is responsible for resources. Like, there's nothing legal about these things that we're being told we cannot do or not. From this unsolicited legal opinion of Parliament, of the advocate, the head of legal services, says it's too expensive. And it is written as a legal opinion. It's not legal opinion. It's an administrative cost consideration. And that is where the problem starts, that we should have sought legal opinion. If we were to go to advocates and to legal people and say, give us an opinion in terms of this process, can we get an external evidence leader to support the work of Parliament? I don't think that will have a problem. We gave an example in the previous meeting that when we're dealing with the Financial Services Regulatory Bill, we called advocates from outside. Actually, Parliament had its own advocate, the Standing Committee on Finance had its own advocate, and the President had his own advocate who gave opinion in terms of the legality of that legislation, and all of them were external. So this is what we have been given here is not a legal opinion. It's a consideration of something else. And I don't think that we must accept it. We should write to the speaker to say that in the process of conducting an inquiry of ESCOM, the NLM president, we need the services of an advocate who is going to help with the evidence leading process. Because that is not outside of the law. It has happened before. Like, there's no one, there's no sound legal argument that will ever say that it's illegal to source that particular service for purposes of determining the issues that relate to governance, procurement, and financial sustainability of the three state-owned companies. We need to come out with a comprehensive and clear report on those because there's a crisis there in terms of what should happen. Perhaps the legal opinion that we can solicit now is what do we do with the protection of some of the witnesses who would want to come and provide information here in Parliament. That is the legal opinion that we can seek. What is the extent of the Protected Disclosures Act? Can they protect them if the Powers and Privileges Act cannot protect them? I'm saying this, Chair, because I know, I actually spoke to I think I spoke to you and Honorable Mondi that there are whistleblowers who are saying that they've been working for some of these institutions that are receiving hundreds of millions without doing anything, where 495 million rand was just paid to them without doing absolutely nothing. And then they want to come, but they need a certain level of insulation from potential threats and protection and prosecution. So we might need to be given some sense of legal advice on that one, not this one of CFO lawyers who say that it's expensive to do certain things. That one must ignore, and then must be given advice on how do we protect the witnesses that are going to come and give evidence about the extent at which hundreds of millions of rands were siphoned off Transnet, ESCOM, and DNL. That is what we should be guided on in terms of... because we must not agree as members of Parliament that Parliament should consistently be incapacitated and weakened from performing its constitutional obligations. We have to conduct the oversight of these institutions in a thorough and impactful way. Of course, we're going to be faced with judicial review, so we must do it in a thorough way. They're going to take us to court after the whole process. And we should be ready for that. It must not be a rush situation. We need lawyers who are going to do it thoroughly, and an external service could be of help in terms of what they require, what is required. But that is how we must deal with it.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think I would like to align myself with what my colleagues have already said and maybe take this matter a little bit backwards. When the decision, when Honorable Singh went to the Chief Whip's Forum with the proposal, you know, with the draft motion, when we had to consider it, one of the things that we said as the United Democratic Movement at the time were very clear. We said, we can follow the portfolio committee route provided that Parliament was going to provide that committee with an evidence leader and make sure that it's also adequately resourced to be able to perform its functions. Now, if we, I'm reminded as I make that point of the biblical story of David and Goliath. It seems as if here we're expected, as David, where David's expected to go and fight with Goliath without a sling or even without a stone, and still be expected to succeed.
It's important for what we are going to do that we are adequately resourced. I cannot understand how, as Honorable Shivambo has put it, how it would be illegal for us to get support in order for us to do our jobs properly. Honorable Gungubele has made an important point to say that with the quasi-judicial process, we have a set of rules. Rules that we can play by and make sure that we're not found wanting when the matter is taken on judicial review. Now, a proposal that says that we must be on autopilot to me, then is illogical. Is illogical. I don't think it's something that we can accept. But I think the other matter, which I don't understand, is that from Parliament and how it views this matter in terms of this cost issue, aren't we supposed to do a proper cost-benefit analysis? Look at the amount of money that we might end up spending in this inquiry and the amount of money that we might end up being able to recoup at the end of the day once this process is done and finalized. That's how we should be viewing this thing. You see, this Parliament, we're always told that when it comes to regular expenditure, that you're always shocked at the end of the year how much regular expenditure there is in the system. And then they say we're not doing our jobs, but they forget that we're not adequately resourced to be able to pick up those irregularities when we do oversight. Now, we're trying to say that we want to help with the process of recouping the funds and be able to make sure that those who are found to have done something wrong are brought to book. And Parliament is saying we're not going to resource you for that. It's unacceptable. We can't accept that. Then it turns this whole thing into a farce. The issue around the question of privilege, I understand and I accept the explanation that was given there. But even as of Vanara during the ad hoc process, I don't recall him making any statements. He was just putting the allegations to the people, and then they would have to respond. And they were usually phrased in terms of questions, because the evidence leader would then have a helicopter view of whatever evidence was in front of us. Remember, as political parties, multi-party as we are, you tend to focus on zooming to certain issues that you think are important, and at times end up treating people unfairly because of having overemphasis on one issue over the other. So you need people who are going to help us to guide the process forward. Obviously, as parliamentarians and politicians, we are going to lead the process. It's a parliamentary process. No evidence leader can come and tell us what to do. It was never the case with Advocate Vanara or in any other portfolio committee or other committee that I certainly participated in. We never dictated to by an evidence leader. It was still a parliamentary process. We drove the process. And it won't be different even now if we were to decide if, for example, Parliament were to give us an evidence leader. So I don't accept that at all, Chairperson. And I think there's a contradiction here. I think on paragraph 31, it says oversight model. It talks about staff are skilled to provide the support, not the kind of support we want. Yeah, general oversight. I agree, staff may be skilled to provide that. But as already indicated, the nature of the problems and the challenges that we're facing now, which surround state capture, are unprecedented. No staff member in the current status quo, this current state of affairs, can claim to have the necessary skills that we require to be able to deal with this matter properly. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much. Obviously, we can't deal with such a very complex and serious matter without a legal opinion. From the presentation, of course, there are quite a number of issues that honorable members were not satisfied with. But surely we can't deal with a complex matter like this one without a legal opinion. And I was listening from the presentation, they were trying to distinguish between a statutory inquiry of the SABC with the work that was supposed to be doing in an oversight board. If the SABC board that was dissolved did not say the Portfolio Committee on Communication is conflicted or has prejudged the then board members, it would have been the Portfolio Committee that would have proceeded with the inquiry. So in this instance, it's the portfolio committee that is proceeding with the inquiry, because at this particular stage, there is no potential witness that has said, you are conflicted. Can you please get another body to proceed with this inquiry? So I'm raising this thing out of the issue that they raised, trying to distinguish the work that the SABC Ad Hoc Committee and the work that was supposed to be doing. I share the same sentiments, the frustrations that honorable members are having around this particular issue. We, of course, we have taken a lot of time without this process, allowing this process to kick off. And surely we can have a process like this one, as complex as it is, without the necessary support. And I'll make a suggestion as I conclude, Honorable Chair. The presentation suggests that the work that we're doing might take considerable more time than envisaged. And my take is that the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises' mandate is not solely to do inquiry work on ESCOM, Transnet, and DNEL. We have got a whole range of other issues that we're supposed to look at. At some stage, we'll have to pause and say, we're done with this work and go back to our day-to-day work. So I'm raising this thing to try and deal with an aspect which suggests that this work must just proceed endlessly, so it can't be correct. At some stage, we must then say, we are done with this inquiry. These are the recommendations. Of course, as has already been indicated, some of the recommendations will suggest that let's refer some of these issues to relevant authorities to take them forward. So I'm, in a way, challenging a few which suggest that if we can't provide the necessary support, like the business lady, the argument should not necessarily be the work might take considerable more time than envisaged and just proceed until 2020 or 2050. So I'm saying at some stage we'll have to say we have concluded the work and can the necessary authorities take the issues forward. And I have a suggestion that I need to make, Honorable Chair. Because whether Parliament will be able to provide the evidence leader or not, this work will have to kick off with the support or with the team that we have on and that we're dealing with on daily basis. And my suggestion, which is a concrete suggestion that I want to present, is that can we in the next meeting perhaps invite the House Chairperson or whoever will be representing his office for the committee to share the frustrations that the committee is faced with regard to this challenging responsibility. And I'm raising this thing because some of the issues that were raised to me are misdirected. We've invited Legal Opinion to come and present a legal opinion on a complex matter. And some of the issues that we're raising them wrongly. I don't see them providing answers to some of the issues that we're raising. That's why I'm saying, Honorable Chair, at some stage, we'll have to agree as the Portfolio Committee to invite the House Chairperson or whoever will be representing his office to come and be part of this meeting, so that we are then able to present, to share with him or her the frustrations that we are faced with as a committee. Because surely the work must kick off so that we are then able to deal with this issue once and for all. It it can't be an issue that we'll just proceed with. This portfolio committee is faced with a whole range of other issues that are supposed to be dealing with. You still have your BRRRs, we still need to look at the quarterly reports of the entities, the other entities, the department, and a whole range of other things that we're supposed to be dealing with. Let's deal with this thing once and for all and go back to the work that we're supposed to be doing in terms of the mandate that we have as the portfolio committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Your concerns, I think, are being noted by the legal team that we have, which I think I will now give over to them. But I want to emphasize on the issue that was raised by one of the members that says, I think it's Member Swart, when he said or Shivambo, when he said you open up in your committee for lawyers or people who want to come and present in your committee or to come and help in the work of the committee that are there. We have been approached by such people who are not even who are not working, who are at home with all the expertise that they have. They want to come and help the committee in doing the work. But my fear as the acting chairperson of the committee, or as the chairperson, I'm sorry, Comrade Honorable Montley, as the chairperson of the committee, I am worried if I can agree that they come to the committee and help the committee in whatever expertise that we need in the committee. How do I pay them if Parliament it does not have money to pay them? How am I going to pay them? And also, is it legal for us to have those people coming to help in the committee without Parliament agreeing on those issues? That is my problem that we have. The more we sit as a committee, we raise these issues, the more there is interest outside to come and help the committee in the inquiry. I also wanted the inquiry to start as of yesterday, but with the kind of concerns that we have raised now, I think we will still have to go a long way, because whoever would want to come and lead us, it must be somebody who have read the documents, who understands what we are looking for, who understands the financials of these entities and the department itself, who understands how these policies are working in the policies of government are working, and what is the responsibilities of the entities or the executive in the entities and the board members in the entities. We need to find somebody who... There are people who are saying they are reading our documents, because our documents are outside there. They are reading our documents. They are aware of what is coming, is what we are looking for, but they are just waiting for us to look for them. They are available. As much as they approached some of the members, they approached me also. Others have approached me as the chairperson of the committee. But I want to give over to the legal team to respond to some issues that we have. At the end of their responses, I want us to take a decision on this legal opinion that is in front of us, a unanimous decision that we must take to take forward to the speaker or the chair of chairs or whoever is in position to respond to us in Parliament. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I hear the overwhelming comments by in favor of an evidence leader by members. And I just want to note that we were asked to look at this issue and look at the risks involved, especially in terms of our rules, as to whether a process exists to call an evidence leader. And I think my opinion tries to indicate that the rules does not provide for such a process. So that's just what I wanted to let members to that. If Parliament decides to to still choose an evidence leader, then that's within the remit of Parliament. Just the issue of quasi-judicial, why we raise this as an important issue is that when you have a particular process, there's particular expectations. So if you want to have a process that is quasi-judicial, when I say that you need to follow procedural rules, I'm not only talking about your basic fairness and unbiased. The committee must consider whether people who are going to be testifying will have to have legal representation. Will they have rights to cross-examine? Will they have rights to call their own witnesses? So it's not simply saying that, oh, of course the process must be fair and unbiased, the members must apply in mind. Those are other issues that we must also be aware of when we embark on this process. And it's within the committee's right to choose that process, but they must also answer those important questions as well. And the other issue about the experts versus evidence leader, my opinion didn't suggest in any way that we cannot have an expert in these particular issues to assist the committee. I think it was just suggesting that the process, the particular process that should be used must be led by members and not an outside person. The expert will be able to assist members in whatever way they require assistance, but in terms of our rules, there is no room for the other person to start, you know, putting questions to members, putting questions in the inquiry. But again, I say that is for the committee to decide. I'm really providing you with the risks that are associated with this task. With regard to the issue of cost, I think while it's an issue maybe of a financial implication, as lawyers we also need to raise all sorts of risks, and it was placed in opinion as other considerations, that just to alert the members of that issue as well. A lot of the other comments, I guess, comments that the members have their own opinion which they disagree with. And I think that, as you said, the committee must make a decision on the way going forward. But, yeah, that is our advice as to the risks associated with the process.
I think, Chair, just to reiterate that our view is not that it's unlawful per se to have an evidence leader. But if you're going to have an evidence leader, you then lend the inquiry to the view that it is a quasi-judicial process where you then need to strictly follow the laws of natural justice. You must remember that the outcome, whatever the recommendation is going to be, it's different to other quasi-judicial processes like Suanne explained, the Ethics Committee or the SABC, where there's an actual finding that affects rights. In this case, the recommendation must still be referred to another body, for example, the WAWQS or Director for Public Prosecution, in which case a secondary process then follows when that person will be given the opportunity and Audi to give their version of the story, to call their witnesses, to cross-examine and so on. So the committee doesn't have the power to find that a person is corrupt or that a person has done something wrong. That must still then be tested afterwards. It is a recommendation that the committee is going to say it must be referred to a relevant body to make that finding. So that is why we were saying that the risk of running it like a quasi-judicial is that you're going to have witnesses that are going to come and demand certain rights to cross-examine, to call their own witnesses, to present further evidence, and so on and so forth, which can then draw the process out. On the question that Honourable Shivambu asked about witnesses and the protection of witnesses, the National Assembly rules provide that witnesses enjoy privilege in the House. Rule 168 in particular says that nothing that they say or produce in terms of documents in a committee can be used against them in a court of law for civil or criminal proceedings. And Section 16 of Powers and Privileges Act. Except to the extent that a witness comes and perjures themselves, In that sense, if they deliberately lie to the committee, or if the proceedings are in relation to a charge based on the evidence. So if, for example, the evidence shows that a person may have committed an act of corruption, then that evidence can be used against the person in court. But other than that, people enjoy privilege before the committee.
Can I ask a direct question? Are you saying this committee cannot recommend that
a certain person within ESCOM, maybe the chairperson of the board, or one of the executive members. This committee cannot recommend that that member should be dismissed.
Now, of course you can make that recommendation, but it will be subject to other procedures then being followed. For example, there's a labour law process that must be followed when a person is going to be dismissed. That procedure would still need to be followed.
Yeah. Honourable Swart, Honourable Singh, Honourable Luyenge.
I think the...
Honourable Kwangwa, Honourable Kwangwa, Honourable Albert, and Honourable Sedi, Honourable Gungubele, all of you, in that order.
I think, Chair, the point is well made that we will make a number of recommendations after an extensive investigation. But I think where the legal advisors are helpful in cautioning us that it doesn't become a judicial matter, because if we approach it from a purely oversight inquiry, then we will be able to say to those witnesses coming, you may not have lawyers with you, you may not cross-examine other witnesses. We had the same issue with the SABC where we had an inquiry leader, where we had lawyers sitting in and sending us lawyers' letters the whole time, and we had to deal with that. So I think it's helpful to separate this process from that SABC matter, and we need to find a way forward in that way of doing it. And I think so that could be helpful. But it doesn't mean the mere fact that we have a person to assist us with leading the evidence means that it is a quasi-judicial matter. So we need to distinguish that. Any witness that comes here will be put under oath. They will swear under oath, and their evidence can be tested. And at the end of the day, again, it will be referred to other... We would make a recommendation like we did with the SABC inquiry. The then minister we thought should not hold that portfolio. It was then up to the president to implement that finding. I think the other point that the Honourable Shivambo mentioned that is a concern is, yes, witnesses coming to Parliament are protected. But what he's saying is where you've got whistleblowers that are concerned about victimization in their organizations, so they might be protected in terms of the Powers and Privileges Act from any civil or criminal act, including disciplinary action. But we know the subtle discrimination, the subtle victimization that takes place, even with the Protected Disclosures Act that we've got. And maybe you could look at the PDA Act. But even with that act in place and having been amended, we still see high levels of victimization. And then that introduces the possibility of where you have a secret witness wanting to come and testify to us, they could apply for evidence in camera or something like that, which could protect their identity for our purposes where there is a genuine, although we want the public to be aware of that, but where it is a very sensitive witness. And we know people's lives are threatened. Let us not forget the SABC inquiry. A journalist lost her life. Suna Fenta, indirect result of that inquiry. So this is high-level issues. We need to protect witnesses. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to agree with Honourable Swart that possibly, as a committee, we need to consider the oversight route because it's less litigious. And we don't want to get involved in litigation and things like that and delay this process. We need to come up with recommendations. But Chair, you know, what I find quite strange, anomalous, is, you know, if we have an ad hoc committee, because there's a resolution before the House of an ad hoc committee, there's no questions, there's no answers, money is found. An ad hoc committee, you know, there's no budget for it. It's outside of the budget. But here now when we want to do something, but we must not fail. We must not stop because this is precedent setting and we need to show that we can get our work done. I want to suggest, Chairperson, I know other colleagues are going to speak, that we form a subcommittee of three members or so to engage with the Speaker or the Speaker's representative as Parliament, as institution, and say these are the things we require to move forward in this very, very important investigation. These are the skills, these are the human resources, these are the financial resources, etc., etc., and we need to engage them, and then we can report back, that subcommittee can report back and say, yes, we've got whatever we want, and we get the work off the ground. But the last point I want to make, Chairperson, is what I made earlier on matters arising, and which was also raised by Honorable Shivambu, is I've been saying in the past, and I'm saying again, we need to advertise the fact that this committee is conducting an inquiry, and anybody, but anybody who wants to give any evidence to this committee in writing must feel free to do so within a given time frame. We then reserve the right to invite that individual or corporate, whoever it is, to make oral submissions. But I think it's very, very important, because you could get this whistleblower who might just be an ordinary worker who knows what's happening about the shenanigans in some of these state-owned enterprises. So I still want to insist that we put out a public advertisement once we've got our ducks in a row. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, Chair, you have guided us properly as it relates to what you want. Now what you want is a recommendation, and the recommendation that is coming to the that is coming from the committee will be unanimous, and it has to be like that. Confirmed by the legal team to say there is enough and sufficient view about this, but she used overwhelming view. It is overwhelming. So already there is a very clear assertion that says what Honorable Singh is saying, to say let us have a delegation, lead a multi-party delegation to the Speaker of Parliament and ensure that we get the necessary resources for this process to kickstart. Here, Chairperson, we are talking of billions. Imali liwe apa sa. Ukombe Honorable Kwangwa is quite correct to say apa we are trying to recoup the money. Ingaphume mntu nomnya. Because this Gupta, we must avoid having a Gupta in the house, and then we find ourselves, you know, sisijikele zenda mnenye apa sibane tisingahambi. Nika sikade lodo. Mawa ambilo msebenzi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to echo thoughts of Honorable Swart. I think an evidence leader will help this committee a lot. The committee members, as far as I know, are not people of legal backgrounds themselves. The alternative would be to co-opt members of parliament who do have legal background to assist the committee, but they are again also busy in other committees, so that will not really work. So an evidence leader is something that is required, as far as I'm concerned, without turning the inquiry into a quasi-judicial process, but leaving it as an inquiry. Then I want to say as well that I have to leave by 12, and I've just made some notes on the framework, and the committee must keep itself open, and open-minded, as if you're going into a cave with a torchlight, and as you shine the light, you realize there's a lot of divergent paths that you need to go down as well that you didn't see before. So we might find our evidence leading us to other paths. Therefore, the framework of the committee must not be limited in its investigation going forward. For I want to propose to you, and I will write to you about this, that there must be an additional investigation or an additional sub-investigation with regard to some of the parties involved in Translate as well. But just to reiterate my previous point is that I think an evidence leader is very necessary for this committee to do its job properly in the end of the day. Thank you very much.
I'm happy with the fact that I think the legal opinion seeks to open our eyes to, you know, some potential risks and problems that we might experience if we were to take a particular route.
But I'm reminded of, you know, lawyers are like economists. I'm reminded of an American CEO who once asked an economist for advice on a particular issue. And then this economist kept on saying, on the other hand, he was clearly frustrated by it. He said, next time I ask for advice from an economist, I'm going to ask for an economist who has one hand, so that then he can stop saying on the other hand. The issue here is that if we were to consult someone else, I'm sure we'd get a completely different opinion on the similar or same set of circumstances. So I'm trying to say that nothing stops us, I mean, as we move along, from getting opinions from other people who can then flesh out details on some of the aspects where the legal opinion might not be clear. But I think Honorable Singh has made a very important point, that from where I'm sitting and from where the UTM is sitting, I think this matter should now be taken to the executive authority, to Parliament, to guide us and advise us. Primarily because when we were in that Chief Whip's Forum, a commitment was made to us that resources would be made available to assist the committee. I want to remind you, Chairperson, that the DA actually cautioned and warned us about this. That the minute you go the route of a portfolio committee, Parliament might be reluctant to provide the additional resources you require in order for you to be able to do your job. It seems that is where we are right now, right? And we must raise it as a concern. That commitment was made at a meeting. We want an evidence leader. If you remember, even during the SABC inquiry, even though they are lawyers or advocates or whatever, were not allowed to speak there, but they were there in the venue. So during breaks, people would consult their lawyers. What are we going to say when technical arguments are raised while we're cross-questioning witnesses? What are we going to say as members of Parliament? I'm not a lawyer. You see, so that support is indeed needed. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Of course, we have identified some potential witnesses as the committee, and I'm directing this question to the research team that was making a presentation. I want to check with them, because some of the potential witnesses, for some reason, there are cases that might have been opened against, be it by law enforcement agencies or they are being investigated at other levels. As much as the Constitution empowers us to summon anyone to come and appear before us, what does the law say in terms of those people who might, can a person say, I can't come and appear before you because I'm going to be compromising myself in order to come and appear, given that already there is a case that has been opened against me?
Thanks, Chair. Like, briefly, is that I think we agree, all of us, that we need an evidence leader, and that we should send a delegation to the Speaker's office to make that plea that we need the evidence leader and all the necessary support that is needed for the committee. That is one. And I think we should agree as well that we should make a public announcement for those that have to make the necessary submissions into this inquiry. And we'll ultimately be the ones who take decisions of whether we invite some of the people to come here, because I know that there are some rascals who want to come to this presentation for political grandstanding and everything else. So we'll know who's relevant. We'll know who's relevant for this purpose. So we must then be able to deal with it properly. And then, and I think that issue which of protection of witnesses must be clearly communicated of what is the extent of protection of the people who are going to come and give evidence here about what is happening. And we must not close, Chair, the possibility of shutting down the cameras for some of the witnesses. I think we should consider that as well, because these highly placed witnesses who have got lots of information that is going to be very useful for this particular process. People who have worked at the, and there is no way they can avoid victimization unless if we say a closed meeting. I think the rules of the National Assembly permits for that to happen, so we can then be able to consider that moving forward. But I think that the major issue now is to make a plea with the Speaker, the leadership of Parliament. I think we'll raise it in the Chief's Forum as well, that this process should be fully supported so that we get to the bottom of what is happening now. Sure.
Thanks, Chair. Very briefly, Chair, when we do this multi-party delegation, which I think is a very good idea to the Speaker, I think that the word plea shouldn't be in our vocabulary. Parliament has an obligation to resource its committees to do their work. So I think we must go there with a very strong mandate as to what our requirements are and put our requirements on the table. There is an obligation for Parliament to make sure that we can execute our constitutional mandate of oversight. And Chair, just to follow up on what Honourable Shivambu said about protecting our witnesses, I think we've seen an increase in political assassinations and that kind of activity happening in our country over the last month and a half. And I think it is absolutely imperative that witnesses know that they will be kept safe when they come to Parliament. And we are going to have to look at ways of making sure, if it includes bringing police protection services in to protect witnesses that come and give evidence, there are people that are desperate to let the country know what's going on, but they know that their lives are at risk. We've said it once, we must say it again. We're not talking about billions of rands here, Chair. We're talking about billions of dollars that we're going to be dealing with. People's lives are going to be severely impacted. Their families' lives are going to be severely impacted. And we have to look at a way that we make sure that people can come to Parliament and know that they will be kept safe when they present evidence. And lastly, Chair, my plea to you is this. As you said, we are now sitting on 3 months down the line from when we first proposed this committee. Can we do this multi-party delegation to the Speaker on an urgent basis? Because, you know, every day we're wasting time, and as I think Honourable Swart said, every day money leaves our country because of what's going on in these state-owned entities. So please, sooner rather than later, this must all be dealt with as a matter of extreme urgency.
That will be part of our recommendations Honourable Kungubeni.
I just want to generally agree with the sentiments expressed by members. I just want to agree with the sentiments expressed by members, but I just want to lay a fear. The reason quasi-judicial is called quasi is because it's not litigious. I hear members saying, when you are quasi-judicial, you don't want to be quasi so that you're not litigious. The reason it says quasi is because it's not meant to be litigious. So it's not judicial. If you go to your basic English, it's a supposedly seemingly resembling. In other words, all what it calls for, try to be as fair, as closer to the court as you can. You are not litigious. That's why it's called quasi. So I'm saying, all what you are saying, I want to stress this thing. If you say you are going to dig into people's lives and end up making recommendations, the process you follow to do that should be a credible process. That's all quasi-judicial means. It's not a litigious process. So I'm saying maybe one day when you overdue, we'll talk about that. But it's not judicial at all. It's not. So it's resembling, seemingly, supposedly, professing to be ostensibly. You can check whatever word you want. It's not judicial. It's quasi. Now, I want to be happy when members are focusing that we need a legal person. Because the risk of a politician who happened to be a legal person can undermine the important principle we have agreed upon, that when we're dealing with issues of governance and corruption, as parties we used to be, we want to be as united as possible. There's one area you don't want to allow ideology. Imali is not ideology. To steal a rand, to dig it, you don't need any ideology. You need technique for bringing it back. Simple as that. So that's why unity is very critical when you deal with these issues. So I would strongly advise against any politician. We've got our legal degrees, some of us, but we don't want to get into this thing because we may drive it our own way. So, yeah. If you were not a democratic Christian, if you're just a Christian, I would understand. So all I'm saying, I think there's a culture of unity. You set yourself in unanimously, and I think we are talking together here. And all what we're saying, we need resources. And the last point which Honorable Nkwanko made, which is very critical by the way, must never undermine it. That cost benefit is a very, very critical issue. When people are investing billions and you just refuse to deploy a million, your seriousness on the matter should be questioned. So all I'm saying, I don't want to have a sense in closing saying that we're being manipulated. I want to live in that way.
Thank you very much, honorable members. There are two or three questions that are directed to you. Then we will have come up with recommendations. There are recommendations that are made, which I think that they are valid recommendations. But I think we need to add more on our recommendations on what we are coming up with today, because we need to go forward and we do not want to delay this process. As much as we do not want to delay it, we do not want to do it willy-nilly. We want to do it effectively and according to law and within the rules of Parliament. I'm giving over to you, legal advisor.
Thank you, Chairperson. The issue of witnesses who have other pending matters. The issue is when a summons is issued, a person has to comply with the summons, it's a criminal offence. The whole question of sub judice, I mean, the courts have dealt with this issue that there's case law, the Medi Television case, where the courts have said that, you know, this rule is meant, is outdated in our constitutional democracy. It does not have application. So if a person is now going to come to Parliament and say, well, they have pending matters and they can't answer them, they cannot do that. They have to answer questions for two members. The issues that they are facing before court or is a separate issue from Parliament conducting its oversight responsibilities. Rule 89 of the NA rules provides for the sub judice, that rule that is applicable to members of Parliament. So that rule is to caution members in their questions so they don't kind of interfere with pending court proceedings. So for them to respect the independence of the judiciary and to respect those processes. So members must just not ask about those pending matters, but they can ask any questions related to their oversight and whatever questions or issues are before the committee. With regard to the issue of closed meetings, Rule 184 of the NA rules does provide for meetings to be closed, and it says the committee or subcommittees can consider a matter of a private nature that is prejudicial to a particular person. So that issue we can deal with through those rules. So So there is provision for closed meetings. And then also evidence given by anyone under oath, there's a privilege in terms of Section 16 of the Powers and Privileges Act, where it will not be used against them unless they perjure themselves. So those are the protections. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, some of the reasons that we had for us to look for an evidence leader, the evidence leader who is a legal expert that we are looking for, would be looking in those things, exactly in those witnesses that we have. In our list of witnesses now, we have 27 witnesses. If we have a legal expert who would be looking at those witnesses, are witnesses that we as a committee have brought forward, a legal person or a legal expert might be able to look at those 27 and come up only with 10 that are key
to what we are looking for. And that person may be able to interview those people and then bring them maybe he will interview 27 of them, but bring to the inquiry, to the committee, or advise the committee that the only people that are key and the only people that can make this inquiry to go forward, it's only 10 of them. That's my view of the legal, of the evidence leader, if we can have an evidence leader. That is what we had in mind, because we would be having a person who would not call anyone to come and just come and play with the process of parliament, which we are doing as our mandate as a committee. I want also to say something on one of the recommendations that have been put here that says we must have a multi-party delegation. I am not sure if we need all parties to be represented, or we need to represent proportionally as we usually do, or we take only three people that we think will be of help to go towards to get to the. Otherwise, we all agree there must be a three people or four, three people to go to the speaker and speak and speak about our concerns. I am also worried with the issue of the evidence leader who is an expert in law. If we can't have that person, even if we go the oversight route, we take lead as members, but if we have that person who is helping us to take the lead in the inquiry, we will be able to do things within law and within the rules of parliament. I think we agree, all of us here. There is no one who is not agreeing with the issue of having an evidence leader that parliament must provide us with. Where they are getting the evidence leader, if it's not the Mr. Vanara that we were looking for, but they must help us to have this does not need a vote or whatever, but all of us are talking on the same thing. Now we are done with the legal opinion, I think, that we have in front of us. We will go and seek Ilendo resources to the speaker. But also, as a committee, we need to put down our recommendations and what we are looking for from the speaker, the type of resources that we are looking for. They have provided us with legal resources, but we still need more from what they have given us. That's what we are saying, Anditi, members. So we will do the recommendations as a committee. Comrade, you, Honorable Shivam.
No, I wanted to maybe, Chair, concretely propose that then the three-member team should be from one from the ANC, one from the DA, and one from the IFP. And then we then can take it from there. Then we take it from there. It will help us.
No. I'm not going to counter anything that takes us forward. Tina, we are clear, you will be part of us as the acting chair, or as the chair. Yeah.
Honorable Mazone, Honorable Singh.
I'm looking around.
Okay, we will be the three of us. We are going to do it as soon as possible. After this meeting, we can sit and write the recommendations of the committee and write also the resources that we need as a committee. Do we make the advertisement of the public comments now, or do we wait for the response from? We need a date first. Okay, all right, no, fine. I think we are done. In our agenda, there was a consideration of a draft program that was put. We do not have a draft program. We do not have a program. We will have a program when we are finished with the recommendations that we have. But we must also not forget that at the beginning of the meeting, we said the minutes must be, when you correct the minutes and you amend the minutes, you reflect on the terms of reference and the amendments that we have in the terms of reference. And also, if we receive those minutes and the terms of reference, you are still free as members to make an input in the terms of reference if we see them. And if you see that some of the issues that we have raised are not on the terms of reference, then you are free to write to the secretary or to me to just highlight what your concern is. Honorable Gungubele, I
just wanted to propose, if it is allowed, that three-member team, depending on the results of this consultation, should also propose an expedient, a quick process, so that there's clarity in terms of timetable, which will finally be adopted by the committee. The certainty around this process has become a serious source of concern.
Thank you very much. We will do that. We will first write. We must write a letter in seeking the attention of the speaker, and then we must tell the speaker how urgently we want to speak to him, because we need to deal with the process. We need to speed up the process. I think we are done with our meeting. I'm not sure, but the meeting is closed. You had.